You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
All righty, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in here today for Tom, and we got a great program in store. As always, going to keep those Freedom Lines open throughout the entire 3 hours. So let me just start off quickly just giving you those Freedom Line numbers, and we're going to get to our guest very quickly here. That number, 1-866-987-TOM, T-H-O-M. That's 1-866-987-8466. But we do have a special guest to start the show out, Eric. His name is William DeBuise, and he is a contributor to the Tom Dispatch, author of 7 books, most recently A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the American Southwest. So without further ado, let's get to our esteemed guest, and let's just get him connected right now. William, how are you doing today?
Doing great. How are you?
Well, it's we're here in that arid climate you're talking about, Arizona, in that low sinkhole with, 110 degree plus heats, but not today. We're not having that kind of weather today. But yeah, tell us a little bit about this. We're kind of at the epicenter of all things arid, hot, and perhaps not great things in store for us in the future here in Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah, well, the climate's going to bring changes to every place on the globe unless we get our hands on this thing. And Phoenix is a pretty good indicator of what might happen in arid areas, inland arid areas, and it's got some pretty tall problems that face it in the coming decades.
Now, William, what are the factors affecting Arizona in particular? As you said, obviously climate change is a global phenomenon, and no part of the earth necessarily is going to be spared. But what's unique about here in Phoenix, Arizona?
Well, the Southwest already lives at pretty low thresholds for major disruption. It's already hot. It's already arid. So any perturbations that make it hotter and drier are going to kind of turn down the screws on the stress. And Phoenix is in a hot, dry place, and it's going to get a lot hotter and probably a good deal drier.
Yeah. Tell us about the potential risk for wildfires. I mean, I've been here in Phoenix and Arizona for approximately almost 20 years now, and it seems each and every year these wildfires that occur are getting more widespread. The damage that they cause is getting more and more severe. I mean, is this all indicative of the climate change that's occurring?
Yes, it is. It's indicative of climate change impacts, but also of a history of human use, which in our management of our forests in the Southwest and throughout the West, we suppressed fire for the better part of the last century. And as a result, those forests are loaded with lots more fuel than they probably ought to have in them. And when you add to that the longer fire season that a warmer climate brings, the higher mean temperatures, and the greater dryness that is all part of the climate change package, you have a prescription for major, major ecological change.
Yeah, and we've definitely experienced that here in Arizona. Tell us a little bit about that record. We had a record of 33 days straight with a 110-degree heat here in Phoenix. I mean, it does sound somewhat apocalyptic as referenced in the article that you wrote. Give us some insight into that.
Well, it's just part of their increasing increasing heating up of the climate. Phoenix is already a hot place. All the objective measurements tell us that it's getting hotter, and it's also making itself hotter because of the buildup of hard masonry buildings and asphalted highways and so forth that act as heat batteries so that when the cool night comes, you don't get much relief. Right now, there is in the Earth's climate system about as much change in the pipeline as we've already experienced. So if we did everything right tomorrow, mm-hmm. we'd still double the heat increment that we've already experienced, which is going to take us up to, I don't know, well north of a degree and a half Celsius. So
wow.
Phoenix, even if we stopped emitting fossil fuel carbon dioxide tomorrow, would still keep heating up for another generation or so.
Unbelievable. What about the water issue here? Because obviously drought and water issues are paramount here in the desert, and, we get a lot of our water from the Colorado River as best we could. What do you foresee with this climate change and the increasing aridity and temperature with respect to water shortages?
Well, the stress on the Colorado is going to increase a lot. And basically, the most optimistic forecasts indicate that the Colorado is probably going to decline in volume by about 10% over the next 10, 15, 20 years. That's optimistic, perhaps. The problem is that there's no slack in the system. The Colorado is already over-obligated, and in fact, the lower basin, which consists of the states of Nevada, California, which is the big dog on this thing, and Arizona, are overusing the Colorado by, 15 or so percent per year.
Wow.
So that's obviously not sustainable. And the overuse, the present overuse, needs to be eliminated as a first step, and then we can start addressing how we're going to deal with the decline of the river that's coming our way.
Now, what would you say, William, with respect to all of these dire apocalyptic predictions? What does Phoenix, Arizona have to do? Because we are one of the largest metropolitan cities in the entire country, the United States. But what would be your prescription for measurable, practical, pragmatic things that we could start doing now and moving forward to reduce, hopefully, any type of catastrophes in the future?
Well, Phoenix is already doing one really important thing, and that is all the extra water that it can bring in, it is storing underground, re-injecting into the water table. And that's the best place to store it because it's relatively safe from evaporation there. Mm-hmm. But there's a whole suite of things that a city like Phoenix ought to be looking at, including its growth patterns, its transportation, its parks, the way it manages heat, in a sense, because green areas can reduce that urban heat island effect I was talking about mm-hmm. before. There are a whole range of things that Phoenix can do to get ready for these changes.
What about deforestation? You mentioned the fact that it's just like a tinderbox there waiting to go off. What measures can we take with respect to that?
Well, that's a tough one because what we're going to see in the Southwest probably with just the sort of loading in the climate system that we've already got is the loss of most of our ponderosa pine and mixed conifer forests throughout the region.
Right.
I mean, the research is really, really good, really strong, and I'm afraid the conclusions are rather dismal. So we've got to take precautions to be able to prevent our watersheds from eroding hugely when they do burn, and that's very hard to do. A lot of these changes are not something that we can, allocate a few dollars and go out and correct right now.
Right.
There are things we're going to have to adapt to and live with.
Yeah, in the interim. And let me ask you one last question here, too, William. With respect to the nuclear power plant, as you know, here in Arizona, we have one of the largest nuclear power plants in the country. Does that have any sort of implications with respect to the climate change that we're experiencing here? Could that also cause some adverse outcomes or events?
Well, I think I'll tell you, in 2003 in Europe, when there was a heat wave, France has a lot of nuclear power.
Correct.
And there was a great deal of concern lest, during that hot time, the water resources that are used to cool the nuclear reactors came up short. And so I don't know in detail about Phoenix's situation, but the Palo Verde nuclear site that's just downstream from Phoenix, it uses Phoenix's waste stream for
right.
its cooling water.
No doubt. Well, listen, William, thank you for your time on the air today. And if people want to learn a little bit more, you have a website they can contact you at?
Well, there's williamdebuise.com, and there's my book, A Great Aridness.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, William. Okay. We appreciate it, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be back with more of the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for today.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. All Alrighty, welcome back, my friends. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in today for Tom. So I'd like to welcome everybody to the table. And as always, I'd like to keep those freedom lines open throughout the program. So anybody and everybody, you have a chance to speak out here live over the public airwaves. Just give us a call at 1-866. That's 987-TOM, T-H-O-M. 1-866-987-8466. Now, Eric, one of the things I want to talk about today, I know we spoke about this last week, but I think it's a big issue, and it's that issue about equality and liberty and freedom as our founding fathers had envisioned it. And just last week, we found out that Senator Rob Portman from Ohio, a conservative Republican, found out that his son was actually gay. His son came out to his mom and his dad and said, look, I can't live this lie anymore. I need to let you know who I am, and I feel it's important that I tell you directly. Well, after that conversation, Senator Rob Portman actually had a change of heart because he had consistently been against marriage equality. And I don't like to call it gay marriage.
Now he gets it.
Yeah, but now all of a sudden he gets it. And, you know, look. Oftentimes, this is what it takes, a sentinel event in your life. And I've told you this, too. It happens with me in my practice of medicine. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I tell people, look, eat well, watch your cholesterol, exercise, diet right. You know, and if you do, you'll avoid adverse events like heart attacks or strokes. But the minute that someone has a heart attack or a stroke, all of a sudden they have an epiphany and they see things in a different light. So maybe that's somewhat analogous here. I mean, it's not exactly, you know, apples to apples comparison, but nonetheless, he did have an epiphany, and he and his wife, you know, turned inward. They prayed. They're very religious people, and they came to the conclusion that, guess what? We are now for marriage equality, because they see now that, hey, this is my son, and if my son has found someone whom he loves, whom he can enter into a monogamous relationship, and that relationship is strong, they respect one another, they care for one another, then, you know, why not? Why not have marriage equality? So this all happened last week.
Is this leading up to a clip?
Well, it's going to lead up to Rob. It's going to lead up to many clips, actually.
Okay, great.
Because I have Rob Portman, Senator Portman's clip on, you know, him saying what he felt. But interestingly enough, last week, as you recall, they had the CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee conference, where they get all the lunatics from the right. I mean, the far, far right lunatics, the Tea Partiers, I mean, you name it, and they all go up there on stage and basically show America, you know, how to really discriminate in style, how to really be bigots.
How you're supposed to really live.
Yes, how you're really supposed to not accept everybody as we the people, and tell everybody that you got to live your lives according to the way we see the world, not the way you see the world. So what I want to do is I want to throw out this topic, and I want to find out from the listening audience here, Tom's audience, you know, one, do you believe in marriage equality? Do you believe that if a man and a man are in love with one another, they should have a right to consummate that love in the institution of marriage? If a woman and a woman happen to love one another, should they have a right to consummate their love in the institution of marriage? And obviously, if a man and a woman have the same kind of feeling, should they have the right to consummate that love?
They already do.
They really do.
Have that, Mike.
I mean, wouldn't it be interesting, though, if all of a sudden the Supreme Court, which is taking up, I think, some of these issues,
banned heterosexual marriage,
you know, said, no, only homosexual marriage is the way of the future. I mean, it'd be interesting to see if they did that. I don't think that is necessarily going to happen. So let me play first Senator Rob Portman accepting, you know, his son's, well, it's not a confession, but, well, it is a confession of sorts, but telling his dad that indeed he is gay, and this is what the dad had to say. Are we ready, Eric?
Yep.
Okay, let's go to the clip.
I'm announcing today a change of heart on an issue that a lot of people feel strongly about. It has to do with gay couples' opportunity to marry. And during my career in the House and also the last couple of years here in the Senate, you know, I've taken a position against gay marriage, rooted in part in my faith and my faith tradition, and had a very personal experience, which is my son came to Jane, my wife and I, told us that he was gay and that it was not a choice, and that, you know, that's just part of who he is, and he'd been that way ever since he could remember. And that launched an interesting process for me, which was kind of rethinking my position, you know, talking to my pastor and other religious leaders, and going through a process of, at the end, changing my position on the issue. I now believe that people ought to have the right to get married.
Okay, so there you have it. That's Senator Rob Portman. And what I think is very important here, Eric, when you listen to what he has to say, because this really, what I really want to dig deeper into with the audience here is not so much the marriage equality issue, which I think obviously to me is a paramount issue. It's very, very important. But really, what is a conservative? What constitutes a modern day conservative? And in this particular clip, if you listen, there's four things that I noted in this, and then we'll get to the listeners here in a second. But he said, one, that his original position was rooted in faith. Okay, that to me is a benchmark feature of many of the modern day conservatives, that a lot of their policies and their positions, their ideology, is really rooted in the faith that they embrace. Okay, number two, he also recognized the fact that this was not a choice, that this is who his son always was. But again, part of conservatism is oftentimes not recognizing the reality of a situation. Okay, we all know that being gay, you know, people who are in their right mind, we know
they've
it's
been
not
around since the beginning of mankind.
Of mankind, probably Neanderthals were gay at some point. You know what I'm saying? I mean, they,
right.
If you look at the historical studies, I think somewhere between 5 to 10% you could find throughout all ages, all millennium, that people have been gay, at least 5 to 10% of the population, if not more. But what's interesting about conservatism is they often defy the facts and reality. I mean, we see it with evolution, where evolution we know occurred over, you know, millions and billions of years, but they say no, that didn't happen.
What was it, 6,000 years?
Yes, we saw it in the debate about rape and forcible rape, how a woman could shut that thing down, you know, by just secreting things downstairs and, you know, fighting off those rapist sperm. I mean, that they're divorced from the reality-based community. But also, Senator Rob Portman talked about rethinking and then ultimately changing his position. See, a modern-day conservative really doesn't rethink a position. They're very steadfast in what they believe, and they're not willing to rethink a position. So not only did he rethink his position, but ultimately he changed his position. And again, that's not something that you commonly see in modern-day conservatives. So I thought it was a very interesting one-minute little speech there, but in it you saw many facets of modern-day conservatism and what it really represents. So we'll be back in a moment. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in today for Tom Hartman, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. All righty, welcome back, my friends. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in today. We've got a full line of callers. The Freedom Lines are open right now. We're talking about marriage equality, but also digging in a little bit deeper to really try to understand, you know, what drives conservative thinking. Why are conservatives so adamantly against the concept of freedom, of liberty, of independence, yet they say they're for that, but when push comes to shove, they want to codify into law bills and regulations that prohibit the free expression of one's liberty, the free expression of one's independence. And that, to me, is something that I think we really got to get to the core of, because I think the GOP really is having their own come-to-Jesus meeting, if you will. They just had the CPAC, and we heard many prominent conservative leaders saying that, look, you know, the marriage equality issue, we've lost on that. We need to move on. Younger conservatives, you look at younger conservatives today, the majority of younger conservatives actually support marriage equality, but yet there's a continuing faction in the conservative movement that are just drawing a line in the sand when it comes to individual liberty and freedom, and that's what we're talking about today. So with that being said, the Freedom Lines are open, 1-866-987-THOM, 1-866-987-8466. So, Eric, why don't you say we field a few calls here and see what's on the minds of the listening public regarding this issue.
Let's do that.
Let's do it. All right, let's go first to Larry. He's on the line from Sirius XM. He's in Santa Rosa Beach, Florida, and he wants to talk about whether or not being gay is a choice or whether it's not a choice. So, Larry, welcome to the table.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. So what are your thoughts on this topic, Larry?
I'm of the mindset that homosexuality is a lifestyle choice. I do not believe that humans are born homosexual. I don't know that there's any cases other than some abnormalities in nature. To stay secular, I don't believe there's any cases in nature where there's any other species that are born homosexual. I know you have some strange species of fish that change, change their sex or whatever. But
now, Larry, you do know, I am a scientist and a doctor. Do you know that actually many species, practically all that I know of, can actually engage in homosexual activity, that it's not something limited to the human species, that it's very, very common in nature for...
Is there proof that that happens?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It does.
Okay, well, I haven't seen that proof. I do have a couple of things that I take issue with. I don't know that there's any documentation that there's 5 to 10% homosexuality through the ages going back to Neanderthal man. Where does that evidence come from? And then my larger point would be, I've got a larger point, and then I do have a faith-based point that I'd like to make.
Sure.
My larger point is, if in fact homosexuality is a natural act and has been going on for millions of or billions of years, mm-hmm. since the beginning of time, or
I wouldn't say billions. Mankind hasn't been around that long, but
well, however long mankind's been around.
All right, let's say that
this conversation isn't about that particular debate, and I don't have that answer. But since mankind's been around, since human has been around, mm-hmm. if there was, or any species, if there is a large percentage of natural born homosexuals, mm-hmm. why wouldn't the population be in a decline mode instead of a progressive continuous
right.
growth mode?
Well, I mean,
homosexuality would stop procreation of the human species. So,
well, and you might look, you
I mean,
might be.
I don't see that.
All right, so let's just play with that point. Not that necessarily I agree with it, but we could also make the argument that is not the world overpopulated right now? It's not a trick question.
In some areas, it's obviously overpopulated.
We have millions and millions and tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, of children living in poverty, living in horrible conditions, and just clearly the world is overpopulated. I mean, we're usurping the resources of Mother Earth, and we're just keep having more and more children being made. So again, I'm not saying I agree with you, but could it not be that evolution has said, hey, guess what? Maybe we need 5 to 10% of the homosexual population because they won't procreate, and that'll be a way of containing or curbing overpopulation. Now, I don't agree with that, but I'm saying from your perspective,
okay,
what you're
well,
saying.
Let's run. I'll take that. I'll cede that, and let's run down the road with that. Why couldn't nature then just have 5% of the population that were infertile?
So we
do have 5 or 10% of the population that is infertile.
All right, let's say there's a population that is infertile. Would you then be saying that if nature, just because of nature, somebody's infertile, should those people be allowed to marry?
I don't know I don't not know what being fertile or not has to do with marriage.
Well, I'm trying to get that. I'm trying to drill down to your premise. But my question is, if two people were infertile, a man and a female, could not conceive, cannot have a baby, should they be allowed to marry?
Okay, now we're going to flip into the faith-based side of my argument, because that, in order for me to answer that, I have to go there.
Okay.
Now, I'm a believer in Jesus Christ, and I'm a believer in God, and I believe in the Bible, mm-hmm. and the Bible states, and my faith believes, that men and women were meant to be joined together in holy matrimony for mm-hmm. one reason.
Right,
one
to procreate.
One major reason. Was that?
To procreate, to get jiggy with it.
Not just to procreate, for family. Mm-hmm. Family is the key. And if you look at a lot of the ills and a lot of the issues and a lot of the problems that we are having in America today, mm-hmm. you can even take God out of the picture if you want to, but it's because of the breakdown of the family unit.
Right, of the heterosexual family unit. 50% of heterosexuals who get married today get divorced within 5 years. I mean, it's a horrible institution, if you ask me. If you look at the numbers, 50% of the people get divorced within 5 years. But listen, I'm going to get to the other calls, but one last question, Larry. So my question to you, including your religious background, if two people were infertile, a heterosexual couple, then according to your faith, I'm interpreting that God would not really want those two people to get married then, because they can't have children and they can't have a family.
Actually, if you read the Bible, you'll get that answer, because God specifically says that there are certain people that should not marry and should not have children.
But should infertile people
in the New Testament?
Well, I'm just look. It's a big book, and I don't have time to read it all. So for, I'm asking you to give me the answer. If what does it say about infertile couples?
It's a big book, and you don't have time to read it all. But you want everyone to be enlightened. It's a big book, and you don't have time to read it all.
I don't have time to read it all. I'm a doctor, Larry. I got to read the medical text to keep up with modern day medicine.
I read the whole book. It was years ago, but I don't remember anything about infertile couples.
I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. It's a big book, and you don't have time to read it all. Wonderful.
That is correct. All right. Well, listen, Larry, I appreciate your time.
I believe for a professional educated man who wants to be a radio talk show host and be able to have an informed conversation with, you should read it.
All right. And I think you should read medical texts,
right,
too.
Let's compare science to
mythology. I would like you to do that, okay? I'll read the Bible if you read my biology text. How's that? All right. I think we lost Larry there. All right. In any case, all right. Well, listen, we appreciate Larry's call. 1-866. Well, I'm hearing from our producers that he was still there, but I would have to beg to differ because even if he was there, I don't think he really was there.
Let's compare science to mythology. That sounds
right. No, absolutely. So, but you know, see, this is the point I'm getting at, Eric, is that, you know, what they'll say is that, look, the whole reason of heterosexual marriage is to procreate, and that's God's plan, and to have a family, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Although I always wonder how it happened with Adam and Eve. If they were the original people, and Adam and Eve actually gave birth to their children,
it would be like the royal couple.
But wouldn't those children then have to sort of, wouldn't it be like incestual? Because
where did the other babies
come from?
It'd
so
be like the royal English.
Right. So they would have to have sort of, you know, polygamy and things like that early on in order to keep procreating if he believes the Bible, if he reads the Bible. But, you know, like I've read the Bible. I'm a Catholic.
I was born and raised Catholic.
I've seen enough of the Bible, but I happen to go.
It's not like you can remember every line of the Bible.
Nor can I remember every line of my medical text, but I just happen to find my medical text a lot more interesting than the Bible at this point in my life. But in any case, 1-866-987-TOM, 1-866-987-THOM. Let's get back to some of the callers here. Let's go next to John on the line from Sirius. He's been holding for some time. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, just wanted to respond quick to your previous caller. I've read the Bible through and through numerous times. I've studied it for like 35 years.
Okay.
So I know a little bit about what it says. And the idea that marriage is just for procreation is a Middle Ages Catholic philosophy. It's not a biblical idea.
Right.
You read the Song of Solomon is all about an erotic love poem between people that are enjoying sex for more than just procreation. So,
right.
You know, his point about marriage only for procreation is just not biblical. And Jesus never mentioned abortion, and he never mentioned homosexuality, which seemed to be the two linchpins in the conservative idea.
And he hung out with 12 guys.
And a prostitute.
And a prostitute, too, to boot. But, you know, have you seen the History Channel's The Bible that's on recently?
I've heard good things about it. I have not caught
it. Historically, it's pretty interesting. I mean, I have to say, I was a little transfixed by it. But I also am sort of taken aback by the fact that it's always a white Jesus, and coming from that part of the world, we know that Jesus was not like pasty white. So I always think it's kind of
Mediterranean looking.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a misinterpretation. But listen, we're coming up against a break here. So you want to make a quick final comment?
Yeah, there's a difference between civil unions and the rite of marriage. I believe the rite of marriage is a religious ceremony, and a civil union is a legal ceremony, a legal contract between individuals. And when you lump both of those together, I think that's sometimes the problem. I think civil unions should be for anybody that wants to be in that.
All right, you got it, John. You got the last word there. Thanks a lot, okay? All right, that's John from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. We're going to be back with more of the Tom Hartman program. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. All righty, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in today for Tom. Appreciate the opportunity. We got a full board of callers right now as we're talking about marriage equality, talking about modern-day conservatives and why they are so against individual liberty and freedom. And we just heard the last caller who was using his biblical interpretation of the worldview as to why Eric, he doesn't believe in marriage equality. But you did do a little bit of quick research on the Google, as President Bush used to refer to it as?
As we all know, the Internet is full of lies.
Full of lies.
This is from medical.net.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I'd say that's pretty reliable.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Well, it says 1,500 animal species practice homosexuality.
1,500?
It's a study they did.
Right, and they're just practicing. They're not even the ones that have perfected it yet, right?
Right, and it says it's mostly among herding animals.
Yes. Is that H-U-R-T-I-N-G?
H-E-R-D.
Okay, I just want to make sure so that there's no misinterpretation here that they're actually
hurting each other.
Hurting each other, yes. Because you know some religious zealot would have called up, see, they're all hurting each other. They said it on the Tom Hartman program. But no, in any case, so it is something that's widely practiced amongst many species. And I wonder, you know, in Noah's Ark, when God had pairs of everything, were they male, female, or could they have been lesbian or homosexual couples?
It wasn't mentioned in the Bible.
I bet you a few lesbian or homosexual couples snuck through there.
It could have been.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well,
especially the hurting ones.
Exactly. Especially the hurting ones. All right. Well, listen, let's go to Robert on the line from New York City, WWRL. He's got to weigh in with his thoughts here. Listen, everybody, I know we got a lot of people on the line right now. I am going to get to every one of your calls. So just be patient. Even if we have to go through the break and we have a few interviews lined up at the top of the next hour, as long as you hold on the line, I will definitely give you time on the air to have your say. Okay. So just be patient with us. So Robert, welcome to the table.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. How's everything out there in New York City, my old alma mater, NYU, down there in Greenwich Village?
Oh, thank you. Actually, I live in Whitestone, Queens, so I just came from Manhattan. But I great listening to you. I just want to say something in reference to the supposed biblical scholars out there.
Yes, yes.
Like the gentleman who used the Bible to say that homosexuality is a no-no.
Yes.
I think the interpretation of the Bible these days is totally taken out of context, especially with New World Translation, which states that for Sodom and Gomorrah, that people, the people from Sodom and Gomorrah wanted to have sex with the angels, which was totally not what the King James Version said, which is not in the not even the actual the original version of the story. So the New World Translation Bible says a whole bunch of or changes into plain English, stating things that didn't actually partake in the King James Version, if you know what I mean.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, look, I mean, just even having sex with angels makes me think it sounds a little bit more like fiction than anything based in reality. But in any case, all right, well, listen, Robert, I appreciate your interpretation and counsel there. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Okay, that's Robert. That's Robert calling in from WWRL. Let's get a few more callers in here, Eric, because we got a lot of people calling in who want to comment here. So let's go next to Sandy, who's out there in Conroe, Texas. So, Sandy, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Good day, Mike, Dr. Mike.
Good day.
I myself am a child of five. I somehow was born a liberal-minded person. The rest of my siblings are not. I have never understood this anti-homosexual thing. To me, it is not. You can go to a church and get married without the license to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And it just doesn't. To me, it seems as though through the years, this has been used by the right to distract people away from really important issues.
And to divide people too, not only to distract, but to oppress people. I mean, come on, let's face it. The great thing, Sandy, as far as I'm concerned anyway, about the United States of America and that our founding fathers' vision was that we are all created equally, that we all have the right to pursue happiness and liberty and independence. And it doesn't matter what your color of your skin is. It doesn't matter what religious beliefs you embrace or you don't embrace. It doesn't matter whom you choose to love or not love. That's what liberty and freedom is all about. And that's why I find this issue a very, very important issue. Look, many people might not know this, but I ran for governor here in Arizona in 2002, okay? I knew I wasn't going to win. I knew that. I was 30-something years old at the time, but I ran as a protest candidate because Arizona is a very conservative place. And I was sick and tired, quite frankly, of the Democrats here in the state kowtowing to these bigots, to these discriminators, and not standing up for true liberty and freedom. And that's why when I ran, and there's a tape to corroborate this, that it was one of the League of Women Voters, and I said on that tape, I said, one day, one day, this is back in 2001 or so, that we will look back upon our discrimination against gay men and gay women the way that we looked upon the discrimination of the women's suffrage movement, when women couldn't vote or when African Americans couldn't sit at the same counter of a diner as a white person would be. And I took that stance, and I knew it was not a very popular stance back then, and I knew it wasn't really the roadmap to victory. But I did it on principle because I wanted to get out there, and I wanted the public to know that this is wrong. That if we live in any society, any state, where there is not equal freedoms for all of our citizens, for every single one of our citizens, then it doesn't matter to me what your economic policy is. It doesn't matter what you're talking about, job growth or job creation or education, because without equality for all, we don't have an America. And to me, this is the most important issue that there could be out there right now, is equality for all. And once you've achieved equality for all, then everything else flows forward. But if you don't have equality for all, then guess what? You need to fight for that and make that happen before you talk about jobs, before you talk about education, before you talk about military defense, because you don't really have an America. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah. May I add something?
Sure.
And that is that I myself have never had to, you know, contemplate, am I homosexual? Am I heterosexual? Let's see. Well, this is such a huge decision.
Right. You never have to do rock, scissors, paper to figure out who you are.
Yeah, and thing I try to express to people who, you know, think that this is a choice. And they, you know, people who have a certain mindset, they're just, you know, that's just the way it is. But anyway, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you, Sandy, for calling in.
I highly enjoy it when you sit in for Tom. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the compliment. All right. Well, listen, we're going to go up against a break right now. But listen, we got a lot of people on the line. Nancy, Levi, Grant, Bruce, Lee, Mark, Johnny, Charles, Diane. I mean, all of you. Just stay put. We're going to get you on the air here. We're going to come back at the top of the hour with more of the Tom Hartman program. So stay with us.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Okay, welcome back to hour number two here. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman today. Appreciate the opportunity, and we do have a special guest on the line. Callers, please hold on. Be patient. We'll get to you. I promise we will definitely hear your voices today. But at the top of this hour, we do have Wendy Weiser on today, and she is the director of the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, and we're going to talk about the Supreme Court hearing Arizona's voting rights case today. We were just talking about marriage equality and equality in general, so this is a good topic to dovetail right into. So without further ado, let me get to Wendy here on the line live right now. Wendy, welcome to the table.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Wendy. Well, Wendy, give our listening audience sort of the synopsis, if you will, of what's happening with respect to the case being heard today in the Supreme Court.
Certainly. The Supreme Court today is hearing a case involving, involving the question of whether Arizona can refuse to accept a federal voter registration form unless it has additional, unless the voter submits additional documentation that Arizona requires. So under federal law, states have to accept and use a federal voter registration form, and the agency, the federal agency in charge of administering that law, said that you can't put any additional documentation requirements on that voter registration form. It is that agency that's in charge of the form, and Arizona has now gone to the Supreme Court and says, no, we do not want to follow that that ruling. We want to be able to require voters to have documentary proof of citizenship with their voter registration form before we'll allow them to register to vote.
Okay, so this seems like another classic case of states' rights versus federal rights going head-to-head, correct?
Absolutely. This case is really about the ability of Congress to pass minimum national standards for voting and to require states to follow those rules. That's really at the heart of this case.
Right. Now,
passed those in the National Voter Registration Act.
Right. So so tell our listeners in specific then, what are the state leaders here in Arizona specifically trying to do to undermine the federal law, and what do you think is at work here underpinning all of this activity? Because it sounds like voter suppression to me.
Well, absolutely. This case also is about real voters being denied the ability to register to vote. Arizona imposed this additional documentation requirement on voters that isn't required in other states and that isn't allowed by federal law. And in the first 20 months under that new requirement, it rejected over 31,000 voter registration applications from citizens who registered using the federal form. So it was a huge numbers of voters who were eligible to vote were rejected under this new requirement.
Right. Now, let me ask you this, because this is something we see often here in Arizona as well, and they often talk about voter fraud and people coming up with false IDs. But from all of the literature that I've looked at, all the studies I've looked at, that seems to be a straw argument, because there doesn't seem to be any voter fraud with respect to false ID that's of any scope or scale that's significant.
That's true. And this case, though, isn't about ID. This case is only about documentary proof of citizenship. And it's really about who gets to decide what a voter has to show to prove their citizenship. Congress made a judgment. It balanced the interests in election integrity, which are important interests, and the interests in voter access. And it decided that voters should be required to do is to swear under oath, check a box that they're citizens, and then if states wanted to challenge that, the states themselves can look at additional evidence, but they can't provide additional requirements on voters.
Correct.
Before getting them to register to vote. They can certainly investigate. They can reject people that they find are non-citizens. But the requirement to voting, Congress wanted to streamline the voter registration process, make it simple, allow for a postcard federal voter registration form that everyone in the country can use in any state to register without having to follow additional requirements that states might choose to impose.
Right, and that would ultimately disenfranchise that sacrosanct right to vote. So
absolutely.
Let me ask you in this particular case, because I believe it is Arizona versus the Intertribal Council of Arizona. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah. So give us some of the key elements of this particular case, because we are unique here in Arizona in the sense that, you know, we have many Native Americans living throughout this great state, and we obviously have many reservations, and they're considered sovereign nations. So give us a little bit of sort of the nuance that's involved with respect to that.
One of the things that Congress was concerned with in passing this uniform requirement is that not only that voter registration should be streamlined and uniform, but it was also concerned with requirements that had a discriminatory impact. Difference at the time it passed Motor Voter 1993, more than 40% of Americans weren't registered to vote. They were largely minorities were especially among the unregistered. And these kinds of requirements, like documentary proof of citizenship requirements, are especially difficult for certain groups of Americans to meet. People living on reservations have a much harder time obtaining citizenship documents. And also people who have naturalized will have a harder time as well. So we found, for example, that 20% of the people that were initially rejected when the law was first in effect were Latino. So that's another group that gets hard hit by these new requirements. And that's exactly the kind of harm that Congress was trying to prevent. It wanted to have a uniform system and then to put the onus on the states to do additional investigation if there are problems. And in fact, Arizona has not come across any problems. They have identified only a small handful of instances where some non-citizens have registered and haven't identified any instances where they voted or where that registration wasn't inadvertent.
Right. No doubt about it. I mean, it's unbelievable what we experience here in Arizona, not only on the voting rights issues, but a lot of the other issues. But let me ask you about that, because you said that simply, you know, the vision was to create it an easy, practical way, streamline it. Someone signs an affidavit, swears, you know, with obviously implications. If you commit voter fraud, then you'll have to suffer the penalties. I mean, shouldn't that just be enough? And like you said, shouldn't the states then have to go back at that point, and if they find voter fraud, to look at it on a case-by-case basis and then, you know, prosecute those individuals, but not undermine a whole system and change a whole system for, you know, maybe a few bad apples?
Right, and that's absolutely the judgment that Congress made. It's really not for the state to revisit that determination. Congress actually weighed that evidence. It expressly considered whether or not they would require documentary proof of citizenship as part of that federal form, and Congress rejected it. and it was passed on a bipartisan basis. Congress said no, that would undermine our ability to actually have mail-in voter registration, to have a streamlined voter registration by postcard, to allow people to do voter registration drives. It would undermine so much of what they were trying to accomplish with this motor voter law to really increase voter registration rates in the country that, it breached a judgment that the onus would be on the individual to swear under penalty of perjury, and right. then the states can do additional investigation but not require documentation as a matter of course as a gateway to registering.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Well, Wendy, let me ask you one last question. So I know we're asking you to look into the crystal ball here, but where do you see the court actually weighing in on this particular issue today?
You know, it's always impossible to predict the way a Supreme Court's going to rule, even after an argument. But that said, the argument went very well. It seemed that the questions that the justices were asking seemed to assume that Arizona has to abide by federal rules. The justices didn't dwell on the question of whether Congress has the authority to regulate federal elections. That's clearly well established. So overall, it seemed like the questioning went well. But again, it's very difficult to predict how a Supreme Court's going to rule.
Well, hopefully they will rule for liberty and independence and what our founding fathers had envisioned, you know, when they in Congress when they made these laws. So, listen, Wendy, we appreciate your time on the air today. And if people want to get in contact with you and learn a little bit more about the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, we can go to our website, correct?
Absolutely. www.Brennan, B-R-E-N-N-A-N, center.org.
Okay, great, Wendy. Well, thanks for your time on the air today.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll be back with more of the Tom Hartman program in a second.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman today, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Hey, welcome back. 20 minutes after the hour, you're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in today for Tom. And I'll tell you, the issue of the day has been equality. We talked about the first hour of marriage equality. We just had Wendy Weiser on. We were talking about voting rights and the infringement of those rights and that there should be equality from that perspective. Well, we have a very interesting sheriff here in town in Arizona for Maricopa County. His name is Joe Arpaio. And again, Joe does not really seem to be keen on equality, particularly when it comes to immigrants or minorities or people of color here in Maricopa County. So with that being said, we have a very special guest on the line right now. His name is Randy Paraz. He is president of Citizens for a Better Arizona. And if you haven't heard about Randy, he actually led the successful recall against the sitting Senate president here in Arizona, Russell Pierce. And this was unprecedented, ladies and gentlemen. Just to put it into historical perspective, this was the first time in the history of America that I'm aware of that a sitting Senate president at a state legislature was actually successfully recalled and then ultimately lost in the recall election and then ultimately lost again in his bid to get back his seat in a subsequent election. So just proves to you, I know Tom often says that, you know, democracy is a participatory sport and tag, you're it. Well, if anyone pretty much represents that in its form for us, it's Randy Paraz. So without further ado, let's welcome to the table, ladies and gentlemen, Randy Paraz. Randy, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's good to have you on today, Randy. So listen, tell people what's happening out here with respect to Joe Arpaio. I gave you a little, run-in there or the prelude there about what happened with Senator Russell Pierce. So these things are actually possible. Is it not correct, these recalls?
Yes, they are. And I think with the thing that happened to Sheriff Arpaio, you're looking at a politician who's been in office for over 20 years. Just, you know, you spent over $8.2 million and got 50.7% of the vote. At the same time, he's one of the most extremist politicians in terms of abusing his power and going after his adversaries, you know, misusing our taxpayer dollars. All these things have been happening under his watch. And so finally, citizens have come together to launch a recall to hold him accountable in an off-presidential election.
Right. So what's happening with respect to the recall, Randy? Tell the listeners, because this is a national audience, what kind of steps need to be taken to recall a sheriff, a Maricopa County sheriff here in Arizona? What are the numbers looking like? How many, you know, signatures or petitions need to be signed? What is the threshold to actually get this recall up and moving?
I think we're about a month and a half into this effort. I think we have to collectively, we created Respect Arizona, which is an official recall committee, and Respect Arizona is leading the way to getting signatures out there, raising money. We need 335,000, 317 signatures to be exact. We're approaching the midway point in terms of valid signatures, and we have over 2 months to go. And so right now, the people at the national level, if they want to weigh in on this particular fight, they should donate to recallourpile.com. That's recall, A-R-P-A-I-O, ourpile.com, to really support this effort. This is a grassroots effort. They're giving people an opportunity to showcase that they're no longer supporting Sheriff Arpaio as their sheriff.
Right. Randy, give the national audience a little flavor, though, too, of some of the transgressions from your perspective of the sheriff's office in Maricopa County, particularly Joe Arpaio, some of the things that have happened over the last years or decades with respect to, you know, immigrants and people of color, right, and also the child molestation cases. Give people a feel of really what this sheriff's office has done.
Absolutely. You have someone who's taken, you know, matters in his own hands in terms of doing these raids and targeting Latino workers on different businesses around the county, breaking up families. You have someone who's misspent over $100 million of our taxpayers to promote his own agenda. You have someone who recently was responsible for not investigating over 400 sex crimes involving women and children, to the extent that these predators were allowed to be repeat offenders. And not only that, but when they just finished their recent investigation, his department sat on it for over a year until the election was over before they showed what was taking place. This is someone who's gone after his opponents, put them in jail, harassed and intimidated them. This is someone who's been who's been investigated by the Department of Justice, just, and was the, one of the findings was that this is the worst case of the racial profiling they've ever seen around any part of the country, targeting Latinos, just stopping them on this whole, you know, then show me your papers, please, law. So this is someone who's really, you know, being pretty much above the law. And so finally, citizens have come together saying, no, we're going to hold him accountable for this abuse of power. And that's been unheard of, because for 20 years, he's been almost like a dictator, above the law and able to demand whatever he wanted. To the extent that he used this agenda of fear and intolerance, and then went out and raised money all over the country, the tune of $8.6 million over the last 3 years, to then fund his last campaign. And so this is the type of politics we're rejecting here in Arizona, and that's why Respect Arizona was created and is moving forward.
Right, no doubt about it. And is it not correct to state that in each subsequent election that he's participated in every 4 years, the margin of victory is getting less and less and less?
Absolutely. What's interesting about this election, that he only got 50.7% of the vote. On election day, more voters came out to vote against Sheriff Arpaio than for it. His margin of victory came from the early ballots that came in, you know, 2 and 3 weeks before the election. And so this is, you know, and most of the funding, over 80% of that funding came from outside Arizona. And predominantly the folks that were given were mostly white folks over the age of 60 who were retired.
Right.
So, you know, that's a different dynamic, our geographic background that's you know, having influence on what's happening in Arizona. So we need to change that. For the first time, our PAL will have to, you know, if we're successful, we will only be successful if people around the country support this effort. This is the civil rights side. This is the struggle. This is about, you know, abuse of power and discrimination taking place in 2013. Unless we can really come together, you know, he'll be able to fight this off as well.
Right. Okay, well, Randy, give us the website one last time before we conclude the interview here, so that at least people, if they're interested in participating and, you know, uprooting the sheriff and getting this recall to be successful, what would they have to do?
They can just go online at www.recallarpaio, and Arpaio is spelled ARPAIO.com, and they can donate online, and we need that type of grassroots support. Whatever amount they can give would be great. We're taking this campaign all around the county. We got to bring another 150,000, another 160,000 signatures. But it'll be a very powerful message to send across the country that Arizona, who's been in the headlines for all the wrong reasons, are finally, you know, standing up for equality and justice and decency here in Arizona.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Well, listen, Randy, keep up the great efforts, and we appreciate your time here on the air and letting the national audience know that you know we can be a beacon of democracy and hope here in the desert. So thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Listen, when we get back, your calls, because we don't have any guests for the rest of the next half hour. So stay tuned, and we'll get to your calls.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay. Okay, welcome back, my friends. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman today on the Tom Hartman Program. We're broadcasting live from the Valley's Progressive Talk here in Phoenix, Arizona. Yes, we do have a progressive station here in the bastion of conservatism, 1480 KPHX. And
we sometimes feel lonely.
We do, but we're out there fighting the good fight for liberty, freedom, and independence for all. So listen, I'm going to get to the callers right now on the Freedom Lines. You guys have been very, very patient. Again, that number is 1-866-987-TOM, T-H-O-M, 1-866-987-8466. So without further ado, let's go next to Charles from Paducah, Kentucky, I think if I'm saying that correctly. Charles, welcome to the table.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you. Is that correct pronunciation, Paducah?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, it is.
Okay, excellent.
I've actually got three things. I've heard a lot of stuff while I've been sitting here that I'd like to comment on, but there's, you know, limited time. First off, one of your first callers, Larry, said that being gay is a choice.
Correct.
I am a believer in God, but mm-hmm. I'm a believer in a God that doesn't discriminate between his believers.
Correct. After all, we all were created in his image, right?
Yes. That being said, it's not a choice. I was born bisexual. I always had equal attraction to both sexes. Mm-hmm. It's not something that I chose. It's something that I thought was normal when I was a little kid.
Right.
How
old were you when you first noticed that you were attracted to both sexes?
Oh, probably 5, 6, pretty
All
early
right.
on.
Yeah, so very early on, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So, second thing, you guys wanted to know what your listeners' idea of a modern conservative is.
Right. I mean, I know what I think it is, but what are your impressions?
Well, I think that a modern conservative is someone who attempts to hide their true face and even the true faces of others around them from the world, from the people.
Right. Well, hold on. All right. Well, you can't really say that kind of stuff on the air. So we have to dump you on that one. But in any case, you got to watch your language here. Okay, listen, let me give you the numbers again. 1-866-987-THOM is the number. Let's go to the next call. Let's try Levi at WCPT in Syracuse, New York. Levi, I believe, is a conservative and would like to comment on this topic. Levi, welcome to the table.
Hey, thanks, Dr. Matt. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
Thanks. Hey, so just real quickly, you know, I think that we're framing this argument wrong. It's really about licensing, correct? I mean, gay people could always cohabitate. They could do some sort of a religious ceremony on their own. But what we're really talking about is the licensing, and that's at the state level, right?
Well, it's not just licensing. I mean, when you talk about marriage equality, it goes beyond that because, you know, part of being married is, you know, having the same rights and liberties and freedoms that married couples have when it comes to visitation rights in a hospital, when it comes to taxes at the state and federal level. I mean, when it comes to property at the time of death of someone. I mean, there's a lot of other things that are involved other than just licensing when it comes to marriage equality.
Right, but that's all done within the license, right? So, you know, the things you just brought up are all justified via the license, right?
Well, one would hope so, but I mean, what you're seeing across the country is that different states want to legislate different laws and want to discriminate based on, depending on which state you are, you know, to deny and abridge those freedoms and privileges that, you know, most states would recognize. So that's why you have to have the federal government come in and say, look, this is an equality issue. I mean, under our Constitution, all people are created equally, and you can't have separate sets of laws in different states that discriminate against people based off of, you know, who they are or how they, you know, choose to live their lives. So that's the problem
But that's what I'm saying is that we're talking about licensing with each state, but even if it was a federal license, it doesn't really matter in the sense that, a license still restricts, in the sense that the government will still restrict certain people from that particular license.
Right. So basically, what's your point, though?
Well, that's my point. What you're saying is that this is somehow some sort of way to hurt another group of people. When in reality, that government sets up this false premise of there's a license to already have this behavior done, which is unnecessary. So why does the government license any marriage? Why does the government have to be involved in anything? Second thing, though, is the government already discriminates against other people. So, for example, age. You can't We are discriminate based on that license. We discriminate licenses for weapons. We discriminate licenses for a lot of things. And I'm not necessarily trying to justify, a state saying gay people can't get married. But at the same point in time is when they set up other frameworks for that relationship to be licensed, gay people are still saying, well, that's not why we want to be called marriage when they say it's civil union.
All right. Well, listen, let me do this. I'm going to get to the other calls, Levi. I appreciate your time on the air, but you were coming in a little garbled, too, there, so didn't get quite clearly what you were saying. So 1-866-987-TOM, T-H-O-M. That's 1-866-987-8466. See, I fundamentally differ, though, Eric, on this because, you know, there are rules and regulations to curtail certain liberties and freedoms, and particularly the big debate right now is the gun rules, the gun regulations. You know, should somebody have, you know, high-powered assault weapons? Should somebody have the right to own a drone and a tank and, you know, a nuclear weapon? I mean, obviously there's common-sense legislation that curtails those particular things. But when it comes to fundamental liberties, when it comes to fundamental freedom, no government, whether it be federal or state, has the right to abridge or take away those rights of those people. And I will go back to what happened with the women's suffrage movement. That should never be relegated to the states, although I'm sure many conservatives today out there, Eric, would say, you know what? You know, we should let the states decide if a woman has a right to vote or not. And same thing with African Americans, you know, the right to, you know, sit in a bus wherever they want to sit in a bus, the right to go to a restaurant and sit wherever they want to sit, the same thing to go to a movie theater,
or a drinking fountain,
whatever it is, those rights shall not be infringed upon or abridged. And it should never, ever be left up to the states to deny somebody liberty or freedom. But see, that's at the centerpiece of today's conservatism. Conservatives really do believe that states should have the right to deny you liberty, to deny you freedom, to deny you independence, particularly if you don't comport with their sort of radical worldview, if you don't sort of accept this way that they look at the world, then guess what? They feel they have a right to infringe upon your liberties and freedom, which is the opposite. It's the absolute opposite of what a liberal is. A liberal can say, you know what? I am diametrically opposed to what you believe in. I don't believe the religious dogma or the doctrine that you embrace. I don't believe in, you know, the scientific or the lack of scientific sort of framework that you embrace. But guess what? That's part of liberty. That's part of freedom. And I will accept that. I don't agree with you. I don't embrace that. But you have the right to do that. And as a consequence, I'm not going to try to curtail your liberties or your freedoms or make life hard for you because I happen to disagree with you. See, that's the liberal perspective. But the conservative perspective is quite the opposite. It's my way or the highway. And if you don't agree with me, then screw you. I'm going to do whatever I can to make your life miserable. And that is the absolute opposite of what the founding fathers created in this country when they talked about equality and liberty for all of America's people. Okay, there's a fundamental difference how liberals and conservatives look at the worldview order. And quite frankly, I think our worldview, the liberal progressive view, comports very nicely with the founding fathers and what the founding fathers envisioned. And on the contrary, the Tea Party people, the conservatives, CPAC, I'm going to play you some of the clips probably in the next hour of what the CPAC attendees had to say about marriage equality. And look, whether it's marriage equality or voting equality or any type of equality, it's the same fundamental theme with them because they don't look at the world like that. They feel they have a right to discriminate against you. When we look at the world differently, we don't feel, as liberals or progressives, we have a right to discriminate against anybody. And that's what liberty and freedom is about, my friends. And I think we got it right. They got it wrong. And I think these elections are showing that more and more and more. And then hopefully over time, the courts will support us as well. So let's get back to some of the other callers. Let's go to Mark on the line from Las Vegas. Mark, and he wants to weigh in about the Bible and biblical teaching. So, Mark, thank you for your patience.
Hi, Dr. Mark. Yes.
Mike, Dr. Mike.
A couple of
you're Mark.
Dr. Mike. I'm sorry. Yes. Hey, I'm an evidence-based kind of a person. Let's put it that way.
Good.
So
I
don't have much time for religion because so much of it is just based on old fables and stories, you know?
Sure.
Now, if you look at the Bible, I mean, that Larry, that earlier caller that laughed at you for not reading the Bible, well, I mean, if you do look at the Bible and Leviticus and so forth, then I'm sure if his children ever disobeyed him, he's going to hell for that because he didn't kill his children according to Leviticus's
Well, not that we know of, Mark. He could have done that. We don't know that.
It could be in the crawl space.
Yes.
Okay. I got you. You know, well, somebody should investigate. Let's put it that way.
Right. There's we've already got our people on him. We wiretapped his phone, and we got the authorities out there.
Oh, no, don't go there. They're going to quote you tomorrow
right.
one of the right-wing blogs.
Exactly.
You know? But there is an author, Bart D. Ehrman, who wrote a book, Misquoting Jesus. And there's an interesting little blurb on that book. New Testament manuscripts were copied by hand, and mistakes and intentional changes abound in the competing manuscript versions. Now think about that, people. Everybody out there. You know, you're not reading the original Aramaic, and even if you were, I mean, Aramaic culture from a couple thousand years ago, what the hell?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Hey, listen, we're up against a hard break here, so Mark, I appreciate your time. Thanks for your patience, okay? All right, there you have it. That's Mark calling in from Las Vegas. We still got a lot of other callers on the line right now. I'm going to get to all your calls, I promise. As long as you hold on the line, I will give you the public airwaves.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman today, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Alrighty, welcome back, my friends. 50 minutes after the hour, the Freedom Express rolling along here live on the Tom Hartman Program. And we have a special guest on the line right now. We'll get to the callers a little bit later here, but stay with us. As I said, we'll definitely get to your calls. We have Victoria Jones on the line from Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
All right, well, give us the scoop. What's happening out there?
Well, the Supreme Court considered a fascinating case today from Arizona about the motor voter law. This is a law that was designed to make it easier for people to register to vote in federal elections. Then Arizona passed a ballot initiative in 2004, Proposition 200, that would require people registering to vote in federal elections to show proof of citizenship. So at the heart of this case is, what trumps what? Federal law or state law? Sort of like, you know,
Rock. Hey, and Victoria, would a video of my birth qualify as proof of citizenship if I showed at a hospital and, you know, my, you know, mother delivering?
I think it would really depend on the hospital, where it was, and whether you actually had signed testimony from the doctor.
Right, right. So it's interesting. Yeah, because we just had Wendy Weiser on today from the Brennan Centers for Democracy and talking about this particular case. So what are we hearing from the court, or what are some of the people who are in attendance saying?
Well, I mean, some sympathy for Arizona, but some skepticism, even actually from Antonin Scalia, who everybody was expecting to be very sympathetic to Arizona, and seemed to be, but where he was skeptical was he seemed to think that Arizona might have actually brought the wrong case, at one point saying, you should have challenged the commission's refusal to place that evidence in the federal form, sort of saying to them, you brought the wrong case to court. And that's interesting, because that could be their downfall. Could not. We probably won't know until June. There was, of course, a lot of skepticism of the case from the more liberal justices. Also today, President Obama nominated Tom Perez, Assistant Attorney General for the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, to be his next Labor Secretary, calling Tom Perez a man who reminds us of this country's promise. Tom Perez would replace Holder Solis, who resigned in January. Mm-hmm. Perez, the son of Dominican immigrants, worked his way through college and law school. And Perez thanked Obama in both English and Spanish, saying, over my career, I've learned that true progress is possible if you keep an open mind, listen to all sides, and focus on results, which he's going to need to do during his hearing, as he will be questioned closely over a number of quite contentious issues.
Now, do you anticipate any filibustering with respect to this nomination as well?
Yes.
We saw it with Brennan.
Yes, we do. It's possible both on the issues, possibly from Chuck Grassley, and off the issues, possibly from Lindsey Graham, over the issue of Benghazi.
Okay, interesting. All right, what else we got in the queue there?
The other thing is interesting Gallup poll out today about the Iraq war a decade after the launch, which is Wednesday. 53% of Americans believe the invasion was a mistake. 42% think it was the right thing to do, including two-thirds of Republicans. 73% of Democrats believe the war was a mistake. The war is more popular now than it was at its height in 2008. Nevertheless, it's much less popular than it was at the beginning of the war. The other big piece of news today, of course, is that former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton came out today and announced her support for gay marriage, supporting it personally and as a matter of policy and law.
Right. Okay. We got to be careful the way we say that, though. Right. She came out today and
For it.
Yes. Okay. Okay. Indeed. All right. What else we got, Victoria?
The other thing is that Cyprus has been told that it can amend the terms of a bailout deal that sparked huge public anger and has roiled the stock markets in Asia, Europe, and the United States. This is the tiny little island of Cyprus. It's also led to heavy cash withdrawals and has caused the banks to be closed not only today, but to remain closed until Thursday.
Interesting. Now, Victoria, I was reading up on this today. Actually, I had a friend of mine back at NYU was from Cyprus. He was very good at math. But in any case, what I'm understanding is this correct that they're looking to sort of garnish about 10% of the savings that people have in the banks in an effort to fund this bailout? And that's why there's a big run on the ATM machines and people trying to withdraw their savings?
Yes, depending how much you have. If you have less than 100,000 euros, they're going to take 6.75%. If you've got more, they'll take 10%. But what they want to do is to renegotiate those terms, which is what they've been told they can do, so that, for example, they could maybe get it down to 3% for the lower income people and up to 12% for the higher income people, or even have a sliding scale, something like that.
But this sounds like theft, doesn't it, Victoria? It sounds like outright theft. I mean, the banks are actually taking a certain percentage of people's deposits. They have no rights or no claims on any of that money.
The banks did that here to us.
That's what the Cypriots think. They say, what about the politicians? What about the banks? They got us into this mess. We didn't do it.
Right. Well, that's outrageous. It sounds like there's a little revolution brewing over there.
Well, they're not happy. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I wouldn't be happy either. All right, Victoria, anything else before we wrap up the segment here that the listening public needs to know?
One other quick thing. Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, is calling for the cruise ship industry to adopt a passenger's bill of rights.
Hmm.
It's coming after a series of high-profile incidents involving cruise ships becoming stranded at sea. He thinks it should be protections for people whose cruise vacations are interrupted for reasons other than weather.
Right, right. Interesting. Yeah, they've had a lot of problems recently, particularly the Carnival cruise, correct?
Yes, and it's since Carnival that he wants those protections. He wants ships to be equipped with backup power generators, operators maintain sanitary conditions in the event of delays, medical personnel on board, and forced to give passengers back their money if their cruises are aborted.
Interesting, interesting. Well, listen, Victoria, as always, it's great to talk to you with Talk Radio News Service. And I would caution, Victoria, if you have any travel plans, I would not take any cruise trips to Cyprus right now.
Good thinking. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, there you have it. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Services. And we will be back at the top of the hour with more of your calls and the final hour of the Tom Hartman program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Okay, welcome back, my friends. Hour number three now, the Freedom Express continuing to chug along. It's Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman today, and I appreciate everybody and the opportunity to speak to you directly. We have a special guest on the line. This is dovetailing right from Victoria Jones from Talk Radio News Service. Talk to us about what was happening in Cyprus and the bank run over there. Well, now we have Lynn Paramore on the line live now. And Lynn is the senior editor for Alternet, co-founder of Recession Wire, and founding editor of New Deal 2.0 to talk about this. So, Lynn, welcome to the table.
Good to be here.
Yeah, Lynn, so, yeah, this is crazy. We were just talking to Victoria Jones and what's happening over there in the little island of Cyprus, right near Greece. And the fact of the matter is, it sounds like they're trying to come up with a bailout plan, but something that I've really never heard of, something where they're going to tax the deposits of the savings accounts of people who have money in the bank in order to effectuate this bailout, and that the citizens have nothing to really pretty much say about this?
Yes, that's exactly right. The finance ministers from the Eurozone countries and the IMF got together and decided that, the banks must be saved at all costs. And this time, in a radical departure of previous policy, depositors are being asked to foot the bill. Normally, in the sort of old world, shareholders and bondholders might be asked to shoulder some of the burden. But we haven't heard about depositors actually being asked to do that. So this is a new round in what I call the global bank shakedown. They're really reaching right into the pockets of ordinary people who have, saved their money and thought that their money was protected in the bank and woke up Saturday to find that that might not be true at all.
Wow. I mean, it's literally theft. Is this not theft, Lynn? I mean, this is actual theft. It's going into someone's account and taking out a chunk of money. You can tell us what the percentages are, because I know it depends on how much money you have, how many euros you have in the bank, et cetera. But, I mean, what's the difference between this and outright theft?
I don't see much difference at all. Under the plan that we found out about Saturday, those account holders who had more than 100,000 euros in the bank would be taxed 9.9%.
Those, and that's 131,000, right?
6.75%. So even people with small bank accounts would be hit very hard by this. And really, this goes back to a really flawed way of thinking about economies. You talked about the freedom train chugging along. Well, the austerity train really only goes downhill.
Right.
And ever since the financial crisis of 2008, there has been one bailout package after another, which really asks for ordinary people who, through no fault of their own, found themselves in this economic mess to shoulder the burden of the mess created by big banks. And if you look in the Bible of neoliberal economics, you will sort of see chapter one, verse one, the banks must be saved at all costs. And that means the ordinary person will be asked to sacrifice her job, her pension, and now even her savings to keep these big banks going.
Now, let me ask you this, Lynn, because you talked about 100,000 euros. So just so people understand, that's about $131,000 in U.S. dollars. So anything under that gets taxed at 6.75%.
Yes.
So let's just say hypothetically you had $100,000. That means they're going to take $6,750, correct, out of your account.
That means that money, you can kiss it goodbye.
Kiss it goodbye, just because, and that goes into the pockets of the bank.
Yes.
To help bail them out for their malfeasance.
The debt. That's exactly right.
And then it's 9.9% over that. So anything above that.
Now the president of Cyprus has been making noises saying that he was essentially blackmailed into taking this deal, and he is attempting to get a better deal whereby the smaller depositors might not be asked to pay so much, but we really don't know how that's going to unfold. There's a parliamentary vote that has to happen in Cyprus in order for this deal to be put into motion. and that was going to be done on Sunday. It was delayed until today. It has been delayed again, so we don't know exactly how this deal is going to unfold or if indeed it will go through.
Boy, I wouldn't even call it a deal. I mean, a deal is giving it too much credence, right?
Bad deal. And unfortunately, there are really no great options at this point. In a sense, the train has left the station in that people are already alerted to the idea that depositors
are on the hook.
You know, their accounts are on the table,
right,
at least, even if this deal doesn't go through. I don't think depositors in the Eurozone are ever going to feel quite so comfortable about their deposits after this, that the issue has even been raised.
Well, let me ask you this, Lynn, because this, I think, has major, major repercussions, not only for, obviously, the small island of Cyprus, but for the world at large, because the people who actually, quote-unquote, you know, concocted this deal is the International Monetary Fund and the European Central Bank, and then a lot of bigger banks, I'm sure, that are based here in America are part of that. I mean, who's to say that this is not the beginning of something that could become widespread and ultimately affect America? I mean, I know we have FDIC insured up to $250,000, but that might just be bogus. If banks are willing to do this, who's to say they might say with that FDIC, forget it, who cares, we need to take money from you guys?
Yes, well, it's interesting. Part of the Cyprus deal, in the deal, the depositors are going to be, if the deal goes through, are going to be offered shares in the bank to compensate themselves for their losses. But that's, of course, a ridiculous idea. Who in the world wants shares of banks that are in this kind of financial trouble? Not me, and I'm sure not you, and nobody in Cyprus wants that either.
It sounds unconstitutional, though.
They thought that their money was safe and insured, and in fact, that didn't turn out to be the case. And there is a great fear that this contagion will spread. If I have an account in Spain or I have an account in Ireland or in Italy, I would be very concerned right now. And you are correct. The big banks like Bank of America, like JP Morgan Chase, they are part of global networks. They can absolutely be impacted. The weakness in the European economy that becomes clear when things like this are happening, that definitely affects our economy. We need the Europeans to buy our products. I mean, we're all connected in this.
Absolutely.
The European ship sinking pulls us down too, and our economy, of course, is in a very fragile state right now. We're just beginning to, see some signs of growth, but that could easily be reversed. And when you talk about, it's interesting, there's a great irony in the fact that Americans have their deposits insured in banks here. The big banks like Bank of America, they love to talk about how much they hate the federal government and how the federal government is regulating them and making it hard for them to do business. But it's the American taxpayer that's ultimately the backstop for the FDIC, for that great insurance plan. And so if they go bust, they know they can rely on the American taxpayer. So now probably a lot of Europeans are rushing to put their money into American banks simply because the U.S. taxpayer is there to foot the bill if something goes wrong.
Boy,
so this is a very kind of perverse, interconnected system in which the only winners in this are the people that own these big banks.
No doubt about it, Lynn. Well, listen, we thank you for your time on the air today. And, you know, I'm hoping that Senator Elizabeth Warren keeps getting the word out that there's no such thing as too big to fail or too big to jail, because we saw what happened in Iceland. You know, Iceland threw these crooks into jail and they cleaned things up, and, you know, they're on much more stable footing now. So, all right, listen, Lynn, we appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, we'll be back with your calls now. We're going to be going bareback for the rest of the program, which means no more guests, just me, you, the phone calls, and talking live over the public airwaves.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, welcome back. We're going to get right to the Freedom Lines right now at 1-866-987-TOM, T-H-O-M. That's 1-866-987-8466. Many of you have been holding for an hour and a half, so God bless you for holding that long. It shows a lot of tenacity and patience, and as a consequence, I'm going to get you guys on the air right now. So let's go first to Lee on the line from Dallas, Texas. I think we're going to go back, Eric, to our discussion about marriage equality. So, Lee, welcome to the table.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you, Lee.
Okay. It's been a thank you for allowing us this voice, and I know it's been a long time, so I've been making notes, and I know there's plenty of people that want to make other comments, so I thought I'd kind of make a list of things, and then y'all can talk about them.
Sounds good.
One is my story. People tend to label me as gay, then some people don't. I really don't care about labels, but the issue is my mother died suspiciously. I have a younger sister. I managed the estate for over 2 years and caught theft going on. Mm-hmm. When I approached my stepfather and his lawyer and broker about this, my adoption papers were expunged. House keys were locked. My inheritance was stolen out from underneath me, even though I was protecting it for other people. That's what everything is about. It's not this... Marriage was a word made up by some right-wing people.
No, wait, but Lee, are you saying that because... Wait, Lee, hold on, let me ask you just so I understand this. Are you saying that you are gay and that the family found that out and as a consequence they took action with the things that you just referenced?
Would come in clothing, every bit of money out of the accounts. That's what they want protection from.
Okay, all right. Well, listen, we appreciate your call there. I was having a hard time hearing you and was asking you some questions. So in any case, let's get to some of the other callers here. Let's see. Next up, I believe, is Johnny on the line from Lanarac, Texas. And let's get to Johnny there. How are you, Johnny?
I'm doing okay. Dr. Newcomb, I want to thank you for having the guts to run for office, even though it was symbolic, considering the kind of political climate this country has been embroiled in for the past 30-plus years.
Thank you, Johnny. I appreciate that.
Maybe you should run for, what's-his-face's office for county sheriff.
Sheriff Joe?
As any other American, and at least you've got a head on your shoulders where his head is in doubt.
Yeah, no question about it.
I got two things for that caller way, way back, several hours ago. His name is
Larry the Bible Thumper.
People like him. You know, Larry, mm-hmm. He lorded the Bible over you.
Yes.
I got two things that I'm sure he would love to hear. Number one, I went through 9 years of Roman Catholic elementary school in the 1960s and early 70s in Queens, New York, and I wound up getting A's in religion without ever having opened up a page in the Bible.
Right.
And that tells you a lot of things.
Sure.
Number two, organized religion here and over in the so-called evil Muslim countries, they rely upon forced attendance, coercion, and brainwashing of young children. Religious zealots are no more confident in the veracity of what they peddle than the Republicans and ultra-cons are of their ability to win over hearts and minds based on the honest, earnest, accurate, fair discourse. That's
right.
Why they engage in cheating on a massive scale over the long haul, not just in recent years, but since I was a little kid and before. We have voter suppression laws, we have intimidation, we have rigging voting machines, and the like. It goes on and on and on. So those are two things our friend Larry should keep in mind.
Right.
And I have an idea for our Republicans, if you'd like to hear it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, you know, that's okay. Go ahead, Johnny. I'm listening.
I don't know what it's called, but the Quakers have this period for young people that they allow them to go off for 6 months or 2 years. It's called Raffenschlanger or something like that.
Right. Right,
you know,
the Amish probably, yeah.
Yeah, so my version of Raffenschlanger for Republicans is you have Republicans, when they reach the age of 40, they go over and spend 6 months with Rick Steves over in Tehran, Iran, and then 6 months in either Paris, France, or Naples, Italy.
Right, and then let him get an education with that. All right, listen, Johnny, I appreciate your patience, and thank you for your counsel today.
Right.
Okay, that's Johnny calling in from Texas here. It's opening up another Freedom Line at 1-866-987-TOM, T-H-O-M. That's 1-866-987-8466. But, Eric, when I was talking about the Bible the other day, look, I mean, I did grow up Catholic, and I was obviously exposed to the Bible. Yeah, so we read the Bible, et cetera. But I wasn't disparaging the Bible or what's in the Bible. But what I was trying to make the point of is that as I got older, you know, I got interested in science. I love science. I became a physician, a doctor, and studied chemistry and biology and physics. And I guess all I'm saying, Eric, is that I see God in my science textbooks. I mean, honestly, if you think about it.
I'm not a doctor, but I totally agree with
right,
that.
Right. So I get more out of my science textbook than I do in the Bible in many instances.
And why can't be the Big Bang and evolution? Why can't that be God?
Right, in a certain sense. Because if you think about it, you know, Think about just biology. Think about DNA. I was helping my daughter. She's in university right now. She's studying biology, and she was studying DNA, you know, deoxynucleic acid. And when you really look at DNA and you look at the cell and look what's happening down at that cellular level, the fact that it can have code and then it can transcribe that code and go over billions and billions of times almost without any error whatsoever. You have all these molecules coming together, then unwinding and untwisting, and it's happening at this microscopic level that we really can't consciously fathom what it's like to be down there. But when I look at that, Eric, and when I've studied that throughout my career, I'm like, wow, there's got to be something greater than what we are. Now, do I think it's a guy with a beard, a white guy sitting in a throne?
It's something bigger than our minds can even
wrap
around.
It's way bigger. And to me, that great energy, that great force, that great mystery could very well be a higher intelligence. It could very well be a God. But it's not the God that Larry subscribes to, that right. I subscribe to, you know, where he's talking about the Bible and some literal interpretation of something that men wrote 2,000 years ago that
to scare people.
Yeah, to scare people.
Keep them in line.
Right. That's not my view of God. But there are parts of the Bible that comport with the way I look at God and the mystery of the universe and God's work. So, like I said, as a doctor, every day I look at a patient, every day I see illness, every time I see disease, every time I see an ability to cure it, I'm looking into the eyes of God. And I'm very confident about that, and I don't need the Bible to corroborate that or anyone telling me that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in today for Tom Hartman, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. All righty, welcome back. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in here for Tom Hartman. We're going to get back to the Freedom Lines here in one quick second. But, Eric, just during that last break, you know, we were talking about, you know, at least what my concept of God is and how I see the beauty of God in the work that I do through medicine and disease and biology and molecules. But to really think about it, I was talking about the DNA, right, and how DNA helps, you know, create all the proteins and everything in your body, the building blocks, the Legos, if you will, to make
basically
it very
– who you are,
yeah,
what you are.
Right. So, and we are just really, if you think about it, a compilation of nitrogen and oxygen and carbon and – you know, all these things bonding together, and that makes the human being, right? It's a bunch of Legos, if you will. It's chemical Legos. So I can't imagine, you know, if there is a God, that God would say, well, I created you in my image, so I use all of these Legos and molecules, but hey, you over there, whatever, somehow or another, I put these molecules together and you turned out gay, and, you know, I don't think you're really quite equal as everybody
or
else.
Disabled. Or
yeah, you're like disabled. So I kind of got it wrong, you know. I mean, isn't God supposed to be sort of like infallible and that whatever right. molecules he puts together, it's made in God's image, right?
Right. Yeah.
Right. So whether you're
which I think is arrogant to begin with.
Yeah, but the point is that if you're born, you know, in God's image, so whether God created you as a gay man or as a gay woman or as somebody who's disabled at birth, you know, somebody's got cerebral palsy or somebody who's just completely healthy, you know, the bottom line is, you know, why would a God discriminate against anybody if we're all made in God's image? And that's what I really don't understand with respect to conservatives and the way that they look at the Bible or interpret the Bible. I mean, look, honestly, if you were to come to me, you know, and say, hey, Dr. Mike, I got some chest pain or I got some, you know, trouble breathing. You know, my first question to you wouldn't be like, well, Erica, are you a Republican or a Democrat, or are you liberal or conservative?
That actually did happen, Mike. I did come to you when I was having pain, and you did not ask me those questions.
I did not ask you those questions. So, you know, because in my eyes, you know, everybody is equal in quote-unquote God's eyes. You know, everybody is God's creation. So I don't discriminate, and that's the way that I look at people from a healthcare perspective. I just wish a lot of these other conservatives would look at people in the same way. I mean, if I were to cut you open and look in your belly, you had surgery, Eric. We know you went through a very serious surgery, and you know,
several
surgeries, right? But it's not like your surgeon cut you open and looks at your colon and says,
oh, you're a liberal.
Oh my God, it's a liberal colon in there, you know, or like, oh my God, it's a conservative colon. When you cut somebody open, the human body, the anatomy and physiology is all the same. Everything looks relatively the same. You can't tell if it's black, white, gay, straight, liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican, atheist, or, you know, devout believer, because that's the bottom line, is that we are all created equally. And I know of no better example to explain that than other than, you know, my perspective as a physician and how, you know, we look at everybody the same, and we should have that same philosophy, if you will, you know, when we conduct ourselves in meeting people through different walks of life, different cultures, different languages, etc. It's actually, the diversity is a beautiful thing. It's not a bad thing. It's actually a good thing, and that's what makes life interesting, and which makes our collective experiences and more enriching. And that's the way ultimately I think we should look at the world. So, any case, let's get back to the Freedom Lines. Let's go to Allentown, Pennsylvania. Let's go to David on the line from Sirius. David, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Dr. Mike, how are you?
Good, good, good. Every day's a blessing, David.
Yeah, well, this is the first time I've ever listened to Sirius Left, so I thought I'd weigh in on this. I think that mainstream culture would be much, much more supportive if they would simply stop using the term marriage, especially since...
If who would stop? If who, David, would stop using marriage?
If the homosexual culture would stop using the term marriage. It's especially since there's a precedent for that already in our culture. I've never heard a homosexual man ever called a lesbian, right? Lesbian has a very specific connotation, does it not?
Sure. Okay.
Okay, so follow my logic. There were, back in the 60s, there were a lot of terms that described homosexual men, and a lot of them were disparaging, and it made people uncomfortable. So mainstream culture gladly accepted a new definition for the word gay, did they not?
I'm not sure. I'm not following your logic right now.
I mean,
well, look, I guess let's jump to the front of the line here. How would you define marriage then?
Well, marriage as defined throughout history has been between a man and a woman. Why can't they just simply come up with either an existing word to signify marriage between like sexes, or make up a new word?
Yeah, but
like
would you
with the term gay?
But wouldn't you argue?
We don't call them homos anymore.
Well, a homosexual.
Yeah, lots of people do.
Lots of people do. I mean,
well,
but any.
Let's be real. Let's stay with mainstream. Let's stay.
All
with
right,
mainstream.
But let's go by your theory though. So what you're saying is that you feel marriage is defined as a union between a man and a woman who love one another, and they want to consummate that into some type of bond that's recognized by society, okay? Well, you know, that's all well and good, but from my perspective, my definition of marriage is basically when two consenting adults come together in a union of mutual love and respect and care and compassion, and they want to consummate that union in perpetuity in the institution of marriage. So to me, you have a different definition of marriage, and just because historically that's been the definition, David, doesn't mean that that's right. I mean, I could say to you, historically, women were seen as second-class citizens, and up until 1920 in America, couldn't even vote. I could say to you, historically, blacks were seen as, you know, three-fifths of a person, which is what it was. Our founding fathers had the three-fifths compromise, and they said that
called bad names, too.
Right, and so, and then we enslaved blacks, and it wasn't until a civil war later that we changed the historical perspective of what we called people. So, do you follow my reasoning? Is that just because historically something is given credence doesn't mean it's necessarily morally or ethically right?
No, I agree with your position. You don't understand. The reason I called wasn't because I disagreed with your position. I was just stating when, anecdotally, when you listen to people talk about this particular topic, what they all seem to center on, if you actually have an objective reporter, what they key on is the term marriage. So if they want to get support, simply change the term.
Yeah, but see, but here, going back to my theory, that would be like you saying back in the 1920s when women wanted to vote and they couldn't vote, that, oh, well, then they should just change the name from voting to, hey, let me, can I participate in an election and say how I feel versus saying voting? I mean, I don't understand your point. I mean, if it's, hold on, Eric's raising his hand.
What's I just up? Want to ask the guy a question.
Yeah, you can ask him.
All right. Hey, I want to know, should we pick a new word, a word out of the dictionary, or should we make a new word up to call it?
I don't know. I'm not a wordsmith. That's up to people that are much more, you know, more intelligent than I am. Remember, I'm just one of those middle class conservative dolts that you guys like to, apparently you guys like to disparage.
I'm not disparaging. You, hey, David, have I ever disparaged you? Have I said anything nasty about you? I'm giving you the airwaves and I'm trying to have a meaningful discussion with you. I'm not, nobody's calling you an adult.
This is my first week listening to Serious Left and I find it somewhat amusing, but.
Okay.
What I'm saying is I agree with your position. I mean, new paragraph. I'm just saying to you that just from a political standpoint, if they would simply change the name or go with another word like they did with the term gay, because
yeah, well, and I understand
community.
All right. Well, listen,
right?
I appreciate your call. Thank you for calling today. I just have to respectfully disagree with you. You don't change it, the name. Like I just said, I mean, if a woman wanted to vote in the 1920s, what you're saying is, well, women shouldn't have said they want to vote. They should call it something differently so that all the men could call it voting and then the women will call it something different. I disagree. If it's a fundamental right, it should be called whatever it is and everybody should be afforded equal access to liberty and freedom and justice under the law, period. But that's me. Okay, let's go next to let's mix it up here a little bit, Eric. Let's go to Liz. Liz is on the line, and she's calling from West Hollywood, California. Liz, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, good morning. I mean, well, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm also from New York, another New Yorker, and I went to the City College.
Okay.
Which was an excellent system at the time.
It still is.
And I haven't lived there in a number of years, so I don't know. But one of the courses we had to take was Contemporary Civilization, two-part course. The first semester, this man comes in with a yarmulke, and I'm only mentioning this because of what he said.
Right.
He was a Jewish scholar, very profound, intelligent man. And he said that the only reason that the Jews outlawed homosexuality was because the race was becoming extinct and they needed to preserve the race. Hmm. So there, any other discussion about it, it was simply a pragmatic solution to a situation of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it had nothing to do with ethics or morality. It was because the race was becoming extinct.
Well,
and
I mean, go ahead. Well, that's
no,
not
go
a,
ahead.
Well, yeah, but what I was going to say, because we're coming up on a break here, but that's not even a germane point anymore today in the sense that, you know what, today you can harvest sperm. Gay people can donate sperm, they can donate eggs, and they can be very proactive in the proliferation of the species. It has nothing to do with procreating anymore, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, there are many gay couples now who do harvest their sperm or eggs and, you know, go through artificial insemination and then ultimately have children of their, own genetic makeup and live happy lives. So, listen, I appreciate the call. I got to go to a break right now, Liz. I do appreciate your comments here. We'll be back with the conclusion as the Freedom Express pulls up to its final stop, its final destination for today.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. A Okay, welcome back. Ladies and gentlemen, let's get right to the Freedom Lines here. We got a short segment. I want to try to get everybody in as much as possible. Let's go first to Tim on the line from Columbus, Ohio, who lives in the European Union part of the year and wants to talk a little bit about what's happening in Cyprus. Tim, welcome to the table.
Yeah, thanks. Hey, you know, this is what's been going on for at least the past 2 years. The ECB and the IMF, they have done this to Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain together. They have forced everyone to follow this virtual same program of it's pure neoliberalism. It's absolute monetarism, supply side. They're destroying what's left of any social welfare state in all of the southern European countries, one by one.
And bailing the banks out with the people's money in the interim.
Right, absolutely. That's it. That's all that they've ever done. The ECB's following World Bank and IMF protocols that they have used on developing countries for the past 30 years.
Right.
And now they're implementing it on developed countries as they can, one by one, picking off the weaker countries in the Eurozone.
Right.
You know, who aren't able to, who don't have their own currency, who don't have an option, they force them to accept these or they're going to crash their economy.
I know. It's horrible. It's horrible.
They have.
All right, listen, Tim, let me get to some of the other callers, though, because I got a lot of people here and I want to make sure everybody gets a little bit of a say. Let's go to Armand on the line from Florida. Armand wants a comment on Cyprus as well.
What's my comment?
Hey, Armand, did you want to comment on Cyprus?
Yes, I do.
Well, go ahead.
What I'm wondering is with the enlightening tag team in Washington, D.C., how they'll take this if the people don't economically revolt in opposition to it. I think that they'll take it as a green light to put more regressive and oppressive taxation and fee measures on the people that bailed out their TARP banksters.
Yeah,
it's
well, listen,
ironic.
I was not a big fan of bailing out the banks. I'm with Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren, where I think there's no such thing as too big to fail. And the problem that we have in this country right now, Armin, is that the banks are considered too big to fail, but the American people are considered too little to matter. So as far as I'm concerned, you know what? It's capitalism. If your banks fail, if you make poor bets, if you want to play it like a casino with derivatives and credit default swaps, then guess what? You should lose your shirt. You should go out of business. And anybody who participated in criminal activities, these bankers, these white-collar criminals, they should be frog marched right into jail. That's how I feel about it. So appreciate the call here. Let's go next to Tim on the line from Detroit, and he wants to talk a little bit about Greek Americans. Tim, welcome to the table.
Yeah, well, the last couple of callers pretty much summed up what I had to say. I mean, the problem with neoliberalism is obviously it puts capitalism above people. You see this now with austerity
right.
programs that are going on in Europe. You have a lot of these austerity types here in America, mostly in the teabagger class. And no country ever in world history has ever grown its way from austerity. You have to invest
right.
in your people. And you do that with New Deal programs, do that with building roads, building bridges. Instead of taxing the Cypriot people, what you do is you invest basically in a giant works project program. You invest
right.
in tourism. You invest in all these programs.
Like FDR did. Economy. Franklin Delano Roosevelt did that. You know, and
right.
And
look how the country prospered.
Well, and that's look, you have two competing schools of economics, and obviously the conservative philosophy, I mean, I know you call it neoliberalism, but I still call it conservatism.
Yes, it's conservative.
You know, they basically look at, you know, fleecing the people. That as far as they're concerned, the masses are there to be robbed, to have their pockets picked. And literally what you're seeing in Cyprus, where you're having a tax, a 6.75% tax on somebody's savings deposits if you have less than $131,000, or it's 9.95% if it's greater than $131,000. I mean, what gives a bank a right to literally take somebody's deposits, their savings, and say, I'm taking this away from you because I made bad business decisions and I need this to bail me out? I mean, that is absolutely unheard of.
All these banks, of course, first remember all these European banks, they colluded with banks like Goldman
yeah.
Sachs, like J.P. Morgan Chase, and they invested in the worst stock option known as
derivatives. Absolutely.
It was
a casino. It was a big casino. And look, they deserve to fail. They deserve to fail, and I'm telling you, there's lots of criminal activity going on at these banks at very high levels, and I'm so happy to see Senator Elizabeth Warren there at the, you know, advocating on behalf of the consumer, talking about, you know, too big to fail, too, you know, but not too big to jail. We're going to see some real, real changes here.
Glass-Steagall Act. We've got to bring back the Glass-Steagall Act.
I mean, I hear you. Listen.
I mean, it can work again.
Sounds good. Now, let me get some other callers right now. Let's try to get a few more in here before we have to conclude for the day. Let's go next to Tina on the line from Jay, New York. Tina, welcome to the program.
Hello, doctor. How are you?
Every day's a blessing, Tina.
Oh, I hear you.
I hope they don't take my money from the bank.
I have so many comments, but I just want to make the one that I had made to the lovely lady that screened the call. And when I first came home, you were talking about God and the beauty of life and creation, et cetera. And then a few calls came in about gay rights, homosexuality, et cetera. And I've come to decide that while the Bible might say that mankind is created in the image of God, we're about as close to God as a rubber duck is to a mallard on a lake.
Well, I would have to tell you, I would agree with you. I mean, because
we need a wake up call as to our limits. That way we can truly exercise our possibility.
Right. We need to be humble and appreciate the gift that we're being given and leave it at that. All right. Listen, I appreciate it. Thank you very much, Tina. Appreciate it there. Okay, that's Tina right there. And let's see. Well, you know what? I don't think we're going to have time for any more, Eric, because we're coming up on the conclusion of the show. But I want to do take an opportunity, as I always do, to thank Tom Hartman and to thank his crew. I mean, you know, everybody on that team is phenomenal.
Absolutely.
And we really enjoy working with them. They put on the best progressive show by far as I'm concerned, in America. And they work hard. They work diligently. And, you know, these listeners, you listeners, should be very proud of the product that's put out there each and every day. So with that being said, I want to thank everybody, all our guests today, for participating in the program, but you, the listeners, as well. And as I always say, dream as though you'll live forever and live as though you could die today. We'll talk to you soon.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.